This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, and thank you very much for downloading the Scotland Outdoors podcast. I'm Mark Stephen, and this week I'm not actually sitting in my garden in Aberdeenshire because today the weather has been brilliant sunshine 1 minute, torrential rain the next minute, brilliant sunshine 1 minute. So frankly, I just don't trust it enough to set up outside because the recording equipment will all get soaked. Yesterday, I actually got a photograph of what's known as a funnel cloud. It looks like a tornado. It didn't quite touch the ground, which apparently is what makes it a tornado. Looked quite benign from where I was, but if you'd like to see it, then visit the Out of Doors Facebook page, and we've got a photograph of it up there. Joining me for this edition of the podcast, slightly further to the south, Helen Needham.
Well, hello. I'm sitting in my home office. Well, what's become my home office, actually, in the past 3 months, and I've got a lovely view, which I find very inspiring place to work from, actually. I look out over the green fields of my family farm, and I can see a whole group of red deer actually having their afternoon snooze in the field in front of me, a bunch of young stags, their ears flapping the flies away. And just beyond that is the River Dee, where I've spent a lot of time recently during lockdown. But a bit nearer is a birch tree that I had never paid any attention to at all since I started working in this room. And I've just really enjoyed watching the birds on that tree, actually, particularly the great tits, the way that they hang upside down and feed from the birch. And I realised today that as we're beyond midsummer now, that actually I miss those early days of spring. It was really special this year.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. And it's funny you should mention great tits, because we've got pine trees out the front of the house, and for some reason they were just swarming there this morning. Very distinctive call. Bird watching is actually the main interest of our guest this week. Ever since he was a boy growing up in the Orkney Islands, which lie to the northeast of the Scottish mainland, Raymond Besant has been, in his own words, a bird nerd, which is no great surprise given the rich array of bird life in that part of the world, as well as mammals like otters, seals and whales. Raymond spent many years working as a photographer for a newspaper in Aberdeen before giving it up to pursue a career in wildlife filmmaking, something he's been doing very successfully ever since, with recent short films which have really captured the public's imagination from his native Orkney on the BBC's Springwatch programme. Raymond joins us now from his home in Kirkwall. Hello, Raymond. What sort of day is it with you?
It's actually a really beautiful day here. I can see out my skylight here that the clouds are kind of whizzing past. It's blue skies, and it's that funny kind of mix where it's quite close and muggy, but the wind's from the north, so it's a kind of cool wind and almost a kind of humid day. So it's a funny kind of day, but it's nice outside.
For folk who haven't been, just describe Orkney to me. What's it like?
I think it's probably one of Scotland's most kind of diverse range of islands. Certainly flying in, you see that it's quite heavily agriculturalised set of islands. But within that, you've still got some really great habitats like wetlands and great seabird cliffs, beaches and rocky shores, and even more than that, to kind of micro level, some of the islands are almost kind of specialists in their own right. So the island of Sandy is by its name, very sandy. It's great sand dunes. And then Hoy is more like, I guess, some of the Western Isles in the Scottish Highlands, where it's more hilly and has some of those more iconic Scottish species, I guess, kind of mountain hares and white-tailed sea eagles, things like that. So a diverse set of islands.
We are going to talk about Orkney's wildlife, but, you know, aside from the wildlife, it is unbelievably rich in archaeology. I mean, I remember talking to one of the archaeologists up there. I said, basically, anybody digging in their back garden in Orkney is going to hit an archaeological site.
We very much took it for granted when we were kids. I mean, it shows how things have changed, but we used to run about inside Scarabury. You could play in it.
I mean, that's a Neolithic village, which is completely preserved because sand basically blasted across the top of the whole thing and filled it in. Yeah, and it's incredible. I mean, you can go into people's houses, a Neolithic house, you know, and there's shelves, there's cupboards, there's bed spaces. It's extraordinary.
We just thought it was just old stuff, you know, when you're 9 or 10 years old, it's just something cool to play in. And a lot of Orkney's like that, you know, as well as the Neolithic sites, you've got all the old World War II buildings and stuff as well that, you know, are kind of slowly falling apart, but we used to play in there as well. Certainly a lot of history as well as natural history.
And it's actually become a bit of a destination for birders, hasn't it? And lots of cruise ships, lots of people want to come to Orkney because of the fact that you have the World Heritage Site status, but also because of the natural environment.
Orkney's probably a bit of a crossroads just now as to where they go next in terms of kind of tourist capacity, because I think it's become so popular, especially with the kind of daily cruise ship arrivals. You know, I think they might be starting to lose a little bit of its charm and shine, certainly for locals, but then of course you want visitors for income and to keep an interest in the place. But certainly over the last 5 or 6 years, there's been a big increase in... Previously, it was somewhere that was slightly more difficult to get to, but now, of course, the transport's so good and accommodation's plentiful, so it's a kind of double-edged sword, really. You can still find those quiet places if you want to, but things have obviously been different this year, but July, August time in Orkney's a very busy place now.
Raymond, we first met, I don't know how many years ago it was now, can you remember?
I think I'd either just finished making my first film, or was still in the throes of doing it, so it must have been 2005 or 6, something like that.
Goodness. Wow, I didn't realise it was that long ago. Yeah. And that was at Fells Huach, which is the RSPB reserve south of Stonehaven. Amazing place, the cliffs. And we decided to meet there because you were in the process of making a film about fulmars, which actually, thinking about it now, was ahead of the curve because you were highlighting the problems and the dangers of them ingesting plastic.
Yeah, I mean, Orkney's got some fantastic seabird cliffs, but I think Fells Huach on the Aberdeenshire coast is as good as any of those. I decided if I wanted to be a wildlife cameraman, I was in my late 20s by then, that I better get on with it. So I started practicing filming seabirds really on the cliffs, really just starting out to see if I was any good at it and see if I could kind of develop it into something a bit more. So, but I enjoyed the kind of research aspect of it as well. And the more I looked into it, I found this little story about fulmars eating plastic. The story in the film really changed from being about seabirds and climate change almost into a film purely about fulmars. So that got me started.
The problem with fulmars ingesting plastic, of picking up plastic out of the sea, is the fact is, you know, it fills their stomachs. And effectively, although they've got full stomachs, they starve to death because it's got no nutritional value whatsoever. And it's very, very difficult for them to avoid it now.
Yeah, it's a really strange situation. I think the guy who gave me a lot of the information that I'm still in touch with is a scientist in the Netherlands, Dr. Jan van Franeker. And he's keen for people all around Scotland, really, to, if they find fulmars on the beach, to send them to him because he needs the stomach contents for analysis. So some fulmars can cope with having plastic in their stomach and sometimes quite a lot of plastic. It's just that it then makes them just a little bit less fit and a bit less good at kind of everything, really. So, you know, if they get a bad winter storm and food's kind of hard to come by, that's when really that little bit of fitness comes into play and is really actually quite important. His analysis actually kind of showed recently that plastic in fulmars is actually starting to go down a little bit. But he doesn't really know why, because on the face of it, you know, there's more plastic in the ocean than ever before. So it's a very small statistical drop, but it's still a drop. So there is some kind of hope there that they've either managed to avoid it or actually some of the plastic they're picking up is reducing a little bit.
That former film that made it, Falchuk, well predated David Attenborough highlighting the issue of plastic in the oceans, and it ended up winning a prize in America, and it really launched your career in wildlife filmmaking. But let me take me back to your childhood now, growing up in Orkney, and a particular bird that fascinated you, the hen harrier.
I became aware quite quickly once I got into birds that Orkney was a special place for hen harriers, and hen harriers were a special bird. So it took me quite a long time to actually see my first one. I was interested in birds really from an early age, kind of six or seven. So, you know, I wasn't allowed to go to these places by myself as much as I wanted to cycle out into the middle of nowhere. But my granddad, actually, I was a dairy farmer, had some ground nearby that's kind of rough grassland, I suppose, that kind of tussocky wet stuff that birds really, really like. So he would see one now and again, and every time we went out there on a second Sunday to visit the grandparents, I'd always be pestering him, "Have you seen a hen harrier?" And he always had, but then I would never see one. But that was my favourite kind of spot, really, to get to kind of go bird watching. Falcons and Merlin, curlew and lapwing, and really just a kind of proper Orkney kind of wetland. So I did eventually see one. I had these old binoculars that were really heavy, like the old style 12 by 40 or really high magnification. I've always been a kind of skinny kind of chap, so my head was always kind of bobbing down the weight of these massive binoculars. I eventually did see one, and it was a male. And I remember just thinking at the time it was slightly different. And then I saw it, and it was moving so fast. And I was so scared that I was going to miss it. And that, actually, it wasn't a male hen harrier. It was just one of the black-headed gulls that hang about there. And so I remember just sprinting as fast as I could and having the binoculars up at my eyes as I was running and getting probably the worst view of a hen harrier ever. I just remember being so happy in a kind of quiet, reserved Arcadian kind of way. I still love hen harriers.
I've got a kind of a mental image of you bursting into your kitchen at home going, "Guess what I've seen?"
Well, that would probably be the normal kind of reaction, but I remember going in back to my granny's house, and everybody was having tea around the table, and they asked if I'd seen anything interesting, and I just said, "Oh no, just the usual, you know, like a linnet and a curlew."
Why? And,
well, I think partly, certainly in the early 80s, bird watching wasn't cool. Like, especially not, I'm one of five kids, and I was always quite reserved about it. I think I still now, I think with filming, I find it hard to kind of blow my own trumpet about stuff. You know, if it's, I'm definitely happy about things, but I guess apart from my granddad, I'd partly probably thought that nobody would really be that interested. I would give out little bits of info probably on the car journey on the way back home. And there was a certain level of interest from my parents. On the way back into Kirkwall, there was a short-eared owl that was often sitting on a particular post, and, you know, I'd ask if we could kind of slowly drive up to it, and it would just sit there and everybody had to be dead quiet. And so I think from the bird watching side of things, you know, unless I got in first when Dad said, "Oh, we're going for a run in the country on Sunday," you know, I'd often be in there first and say, "Oh, can we go to the Bursey bird hide?" And everybody, this big groan from everybody that, God, we're going bird watching again, you know, because everybody just wanted to go to the beach and, you know, have a good time.
Well, back to the hen harriers now, because you obviously loved them from a young age, and that was a thrilling moment when you first saw that male hen harrier. But you've actually filmed them since then and managed to weave in a particular story that relates to them from Orkney and a significant character, Eddie Balfour.
Probably like a lot of the kind of more remoter places in Scotland, it's often hard to find local people that are working in conservation, particularly, I think. So for me to find out that there was a full-on proper Arcadian man that was the world expert in hen harriers, for me was just like, wow, this is, you know, just the best thing ever. So, but again, I think a character that's kind of gone under the radar a little bit, because he was a farmer and he was from a farming family, but he watched hen harriers in his spare time. He was probably regarded as being a birdie man, which sometimes in farming circles isn't always a a positive spin on things. So he spent an enormous amount of time out in the field watching hen harriers, to the point where he could go back year after year to every single hen harrier nest in Orkney. It ended up turning into the longest running raptor study in the world. So he started early 40s, mid 40s, carried on through to the 70s. Lots of today's studies into hen harriers are really based on his work.
I mean, there's a lot of recording, a lot of note-taking involved with that kind of research. Did he find anything significant?
I was very lucky to be able to get access to his original notebooks. And it's just incredible, really. I mean, he worked on clutch sizes. He discovered that Orkney's population was kind of skewed and that there was a lot more females than males. Because normally what you find with hen harriers is that they do this beautiful sky dance in kind of early spring. Usually kind of third week of April is a good bet if you get a nice warm sunny day, and the male rises high up into the sky and he's kind of making a kind of ki-ki-ki-ki-ki-ki call, and he'll drop to the ground and you think he's about to hit the ground, he'll just fire straight back up, and he'll do that along a kind of hillside, really to attract a female. But in Orkney, you often find that females are doing the sky dancing because there's much more females than there are males. So really the males don't have to compete for females here. It's the other way around. So he discovered that, and then that hen harriers were very much polygynous in Orkney. If there's plenty of food for the male to catch, then he'll try to provision more than one nest. I think his field work was second to none.
I wonder what effect that has on the longevity. I've always had a sneaking admiration for bigamists, because looking after one family has knackered me.
Yeah, well, I think that, again, it's really kind of food-related. You know, if really he should be kind of provisioning the female as she's kind of getting into condition for egg-laying. So presumably for him to provision three or four birds, then there's obviously plenty of food, but they do come unstuck where there's always a kind of alpha nest, and then the others suffer to a greater or lesser extent where the third most popular nest often fails, or even the second one. It's one of those strategies that works when things are good and probably sets them back a little bit when things aren't quite so good.
Hen harriers do this remarkable thing too, where they, you know, one of them will come off the ground and they do a transfer of food in midair, you know, with one of them up flying essentially upside down. It's extraordinary.
Yeah, food pass. You don't see it right through the year or right through the breeding season. The female, when she's confident that the chicks are big enough to kind of fend for themselves if there's a squally shower or something like that, she'll go and hunt as well, so there's no need to do the food pass. But certainly when she's on eggs, you know, she can't go and hunt, because the, you know, hooded crow or a raven or something might come in and try and take the eggs. So if you're watching the nest, you'll often hear the call first, so you get a little bit of warning if you're trying to film it that something's about to happen, and then you've just got kind of got a hope that the harrier's coming in the direction that he wants. So yeah, she'll fly up kind of almost straight up from the nest. It generally happens quite close to the nest. He'll come in, depending how experienced he is, he'll either make a good pass, in which case she'll grab it straight away, or he'll make a bit of a hash of it. I've seen him drop it into the rushes, and then she has to go off and find it. It's a spectacular piece of behaviour.
Let's speak about another species, black guillemot. Do you call them tysties in Orkney too?
We do, yeah.
You do? Ah, right. Well, describe a tysty to me and the courting ritual.
So a tysty is a seabird, so it's a member of the auk family. Probably the closest thing that it resembles is actually another guillemot, funnily enough, the common guillemot. Bigger than a puffin, but it's a very dapper-looking bird. So in the middle of summer, it's black and has a kind of white wing patch, but it's got bright red feet. And if you hear it call and it opens its bill, it's got a bright red inside to its bill as well. Very much a coastal bird in Scotland. It doesn't tend to move far from where it nests. So, but it changes plumage in winter, and it's a bit more scruffy looking. It changes almost to kind of white with these kind of charcoaly specks in it. But some birds have already changed back to their summer plumage late February. So you know, you can see that they're already starting to think about getting into breeding mode.
They have these scarlet legs, and when they gape, You know, when the mouth opens, wow. You know, it's a real visual treat.
Yeah, and they really use that when they're in the courtship displays. So they have quite a long breeding season. So you'll start to see these rafts of birds offshore, maybe April time, and then kind of early May, they'll start to come on shore. And if you really want to see the courtship display, or a good one, you're going to have to get up really early, I'm afraid. Often the best time is just as it's getting light. So in Orkney, springtime, you know, you're speaking 4 o'clock in the morning, really. It's a bit like when puffins do that billing as well. It basically sets off every other puffin in the area, and it's the same for black guillemots. You know, one will start doing its courtship, and the rest of them just can't seem to resist doing it, so they do this. It's called a pelican walk. So it'll stand up really straight, kind of straight back. It'll start moving its head from side to side really quickly. And you can see its chest pumping as it's doing it. So it's kind of going, but also doing a Ministry of Silly Walks, kind of plodding. So it's just, it's comical, but it's beautiful as well. But it never seems to end gracefully either. It always just, somebody gets a bit too excited and then bumps into another one and it'll fly off. But like a lot of seabirds, you'll see them displaying right through the summer. It might be birds that haven't, you know, managed to successfully nest or just practicing. Some of the North Isles here, especially Papa Westry and North Isles, you get some really great congregations of black guillemots. It's fun to watch.
It was the black guillemot that actually inspired you to go into photography in the first place. One of the first birds that you actually took a picture of.
I used to go on some of the local ringing group trips, partly as a way of learning about birds, but also it was a good opportunity to get close to birds to photograph, so I could take advantage of the fact that they were going out to Spona in the Pentland Firth or the Pentland Skerries. It was a kind of slightly sneaky way, I guess, of getting to some of these more remoter places, but for me at that time, I didn't have very good kit, or, you know, I just had a kind of bog standard camera. I couldn't use lenses to get close to what I wanted to photograph, so I had to physically get close to what I wanted to photograph. So seabirds kind of allowed me to do that. Fulmars were another one, black guillemots. And I just remember thinking how beautiful they were, and that kind of started me off into trying to take photography a bit more seriously.
You made a beautiful film about otters recently for BBC Springwatch from Orkney. And otters are one of those animals that are notoriously difficult to film. How did you go about filming them?
I was really quite lucky, I think, because I've been fortunate to film otters quite a lot, really, for different programmes. I was doing some more up in Shetland earlier this year as well, and hopefully if the restrictions ease a bit more, I can get back up to do a bit more. But I'd always been kind of slightly wary of pitching any kind of film about otters in Orkney, because it's just not like Shetland. It's one of those animals, I think, that I've just become endlessly fascinated by, because I know that I'm never going to know everything there is to know about otters. You know, you think you're doing well following them for a week, and then suddenly they'll just disappear and you have no reason why. It might be that they fished an area out, or, you know, there's been a family dispute or something like that. So I think part of the problem in Orkney is more kind of habitat related rather than actually there being not that many otters. I think the otters in Orkney have just kind of had to adapt really to having less of their kind of favoured holt sites. So holts in Orkney are really quite difficult to find compared to Shetland. And I think certainly otters in Shetland love that kind of blanket peat that comes right down to the shore, especially in the Vos. And that would be their kind of favourite place to make holts. That habitat used to be in Orkney, and there's still a little bit of it in some of the more remoter places, and you still find otter holts in those habitats, but a lot of that's been lost to agriculture through the years. You know, otters in Orkney will use anything really for holts: old buildings, piles of old bruck and pallets and stuff lying about, drainage pipes. So they're definitely here. But yeah, I had a very, I'm kind of loath to use the word tame otter, but I had a very trusting otter that allowed me some really close approaches for about a month, actually, on Stennis Loch. And that allowed me to kind of build up a little bit of footage to then say, to the producers, I can make a film about otters in Orkney, because I had a little bit of backup before I went in with it.
So how long does it take then to gather this kind of material? Because when you watch like a two-minute film, you think, oh, that all happened at once. But that's not necessarily the case. You have to be extremely patient, I imagine.
I think partly it's just trying to kind of keep a lid on your frustration. You can see something happening and it's either too far away or the light's not right or you haven't got the tripod down in time and something's already happened. So people often say, oh, you must be really patient. But I think it's partly fear of not getting a shot that makes you stay there longer or until it's dark, or you know, you're hungry and you'd rather go home and have a cup of tea. Being tenacious is probably slightly more the kind of way that I would look at it. But those short films have to work. It's a 5-minute film, so you don't have the budget of a Planet Earth or something like that. So if you pitch the idea, you better make sure that you can deliver it, because there's no kind of leeway. So you've got to find a subject that you can cover and cover well enough that's got, you know, enough of a body of a story to make it work. So in some ways those short films are actually harder than having weeks on end to film one sequence.
I watched the otter film that you made for Springwatch, and let's face it, you were exceptionally lucky in one regard, the backdrop, you know, because you can see the stone circle up the back behind the Loch Ness, and it's a Neolithic landscape, and, you know, there's these fabulous animals in the foreground and there's fabulous archaeology in the background.
I think the series producer on Springwatch, he, as well as liking animals, he also really likes the idea of animals in the landscape and the history aspect as well. So in some ways I knew that I was kind of onto a good thing, or that he might want to go with it. But the thing that kind of piqued my interest, as well as having a really accessible otter that was a bit easier than normal to film, was in that area somebody had found a fishing sinker. It's almost like a kind of shape of an axe head, but much bigger. It's actually in the Hunterian Museum in Glasgow now. They think it's dated late Iron Age, maybe Viking Age, and it's got a depiction of an otter fishing on it. And I just thought,
wow,
that's just absolutely magic. You know, that's like such a great story that, you know, here's this otter, this dog otter, not far from where somebody fishing saw an otter, you know, 1,000 years ago, and deemed it interesting enough to spend the time chipping it into a stone for his own fishing sinker. I just thought that's a brilliant link up. The mix of natural history and the archaeology really came together for that one.
Recently we spoke to a friend of mine who's was a wildlife filmmaker, and she now, one of the things she does is she's on the board of a local wetland reserve down in Norfolk. And she sent me a photograph a while ago, and I didn't know that otters did this. Effectively, this thing was porpoising out of the water. It obviously swam at some speed. It cleared, just about cleared the water. The tail end of the animal was still beneath the surface. But the front end, it kind of tucked its feet up, and I looked at it and I thought, that reminds me of something. That image reminds me of something. It was fascinating in and of itself. There is a mythical creature which is carved regularly on Pictish stones, and it's always described as a mythical creature, and its front legs are tucked up in exactly that way. And I've looked at it several times thinking, is it meant to be an otter? But I don't think it is.
Yeah, I think initially when that stone was found, they thought the depiction was actually a seal, and have since thought, well, actually it's an otter, because it definitely looks like it's legs rather than flippers. But yeah, I think otter certainly had a significance in Orkney that probably was slightly more than a food source and fur, although that definitely happened as well. You know, there's remains that have got cut marks that were potentially from skinning the animals. But there was, I think it was 3 skulls were found at Scarabray and kind of arranged, and, you know, which would point to the animal being a bit more important than just a food source. So, yeah, it's certainly been an Orkney since Neolithic times.
Interesting idea. It was so it could potentially be an almost like a clan totem for the folk of Scarabray.
Yeah, I'm probably not the right person to
Speculate. Who's going to sue you?
there's so many archaeologists in Orkney, they'll be tearing their hair out if I say that. There's certainly two of the eagles were important, yes. And Cooin Hill and Wideford Hill as well, where there was lots of dog bones. So it's not a mad idea, but it's not one I'm going to make.
you're not going to wholeheartedly endorse it, either. No. Listen, you brought them up, so let's talk about them now. Grey seals.
Yes. Well, depending who you speak to, but it's hard not to like seals, or I think so anyway. And again, an animal that was very visual when I was young. My granny lived down on Hoy at Lyness there. It was always seals bobbing about on the just offshore. Really, Hoy for us when we were kids was just a playground, you know, we could just do whatever we wanted and never inside. But I do remember my dad used to go fishing for sea trout just further along the coast towards the Martello Tower. It was kind of foggy and I thought, oh, I'll go and find him. So I was on the shore by myself. I just stopped in my tracks. I heard this noise and I was so scared. The worst thing about it was it was echoing in this old World War II building, so I couldn't really tell where the noise was coming from. And I legged it back to my granny's house. I thought, I'll keep quiet, because I realised what it was when I got back to the house. And I thought, oh God, you know, everybody's going to take the mickey out of me for this. So I stayed quiet, and then my dad came in and he says, oh, what were you running along the shore for? And I thought, oh, I've been rumbled here, but that's my only kind of scary, silky experience. Yeah, they're fantastic animals. They're great to film because they display so much behaviour, you know, during the breeding season. So it's always a kind of highlight in the Orkney Wildlife Calendar for me.
To hear seals singing is a fabulous sound. I remember going years ago up with a guy called Uwe Stoneman, who worked for the Scottish Wildlife Trust, up near Durness. There was a sea loch there. I can't remember the name of the loch. But, you know, we stayed in this bothy and we sat outside as it got dark and we just listened to the seals because they were about half a mile away. And these voices are just echoing out of the cliffs. It's a fabulous sound.
Yeah, you can really understand why there's so much folklore around seals, all the stories of Selkie folk. And most of them are quite benign, I think, but there's also the Finn folk.
You better explain that. Right? For folk that don't come from Orkney, you better explain the difference between the Selkies and the Finn folk.
The Finn folk were almost just like Selkies or Selkie people, but with a mischievous, more of an ill will, where I think the Selkie stories are more about Selkies coming ashore at certain times of year to, I heard it described as the other day, as satisfying unsatisfied women or something like that, where it's... It's funny how it always kind of goes back to that kind of thing, but also kind of sadder stories, you know, where the woman had come ashore as a Selkie. They're obviously always very beautiful as well, of course. So
obviously, nobody wants an ugly Selkie.
No, that's true. and the guy that had fallen in love with her had kept her Selkie coat, so she couldn't go back to sea. Had to spend the rest of her days as a kind of half human. So it's, yeah, all these kind of mythical stories, you can really understand where they've come from.
You've been giving me goosebumps actually just talking about some of these things, particularly the otter and finding the carving and things, and just having that opportunity in some way to connect through the wildlife that's happening now, but that has been there for thousands and thousands of years. And that's just in Orkney. You've actually filmed all over the world now. Tell us about some of your highlights of the places you've been. I know that you were in Tibet, for example.
I was over there 2 summers ago. That was quite a long shoot, that one. That was 9 weeks. I was basically sent there as part of a team to film wolves, really. It was one of the places I'd always wanted to go. I think physically, that was probably the toughest shoot I've ever done. Working mostly about 5,000 metres.
Wow.
So there's a lot of hide work as well. I spend a lot of time just sitting in hides, waiting for things to appear. You'd almost kind of forget that you were working at altitude because you'd be sitting there and you'd just be fiddling about with the camera. And then all of a sudden, you would just start breathing really fast. You'd just be almost kind of getting a tight chest, just as a reminder that you're, you know, you're not really meant to be there. And I lost 2 stone on that shoot, which...
Wow.
Yeah, it was...
5,000 metres, what, 16,000 feet. And basically, you know, if you're in a plane, like a light aircraft, you will be on oxygen after 10,000 feet. You know, if you get any higher than that, you have to be on oxygen. Because it impairs your cognitive abilities.
Any kind of exertion, like putting a hide up halfway up a hill or something, you are just out of breath the whole time. You know, it's... And not so much a case of fitness either. It's a funny one. You know, we're told before we went really that you can't train particularly for working at for altitude. You know, it affects different people in different ways. Some of the other part of the team, you know, did get altitude sickness. So I was quite lucky, but it's tough working at those kind of conditions.
So what did you see?
I did see wolves. Had just the most amazing experience. I can see him right now because I framed the picture of a screen grab that I took off the camera. So the wolves that were there were kind of quite wary, but kind of okay with our presence. But they'd always be a kind of a good 50, 70 metres away. So they always knew you were there. You know, you can never sneak up on them or anything like that. So, but I was sitting in the hide the one day and heard a kind of garbled message over the radio from the support car. And I looked up to the horizon, and there was a wolf on the horizon. It was looking straight at the hide, and it was unlike any other ones, and it was almost pure white. And it started trotting towards the hide, and I'm thinking, this is really cool, and trying to keep it in focus as it trots towards me, and then it gets closer and closer and closer. And my heart's really thumping by this stage, and I can see my hand on the tripod arm starting to shake a little bit, and it stopped about 8 metres in front of the hide, and it looked directly in the filming hole, and then it just sat down and it started licking its feet. And I remember thinking, I am so, so lucky. I was the only one in the hide, obviously, but I could hardly contain myself. And I actually, as slightly soppy as this sounds, I started crying.
Yeah, I can well believe it.
It was just this incredible, magical, I don't know if you would even call it an interaction, but for me it was, you know, an animal in its environment that obviously knew there was something slightly different in there that it wanted to investigate, but was in no way aggressive. Yeah, that was, yeah, a real highlight, not just for that trip, but for a lot of the shoots I've done.
Raymond, I've found this absolutely fascinating. Thank you so much for joining us on the Scotland Outdoors podcast. If you would like to see some of Raymond's work, there is a beautiful film he made of Orkney on the BBC Springwatch page called Magic Moments, The Orkney Isles. Anybody else that you would like us to speak to, any ideas, please get in touch with us. We'd like to hear what you think of this podcast. If you've got the time, like it, refer it to a friend, the more the merrier. Email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk with anything you want to say to us. From myself, Mark Stephen, Helen Needham and Raymond Bassant, thanks for listening.